From KUOW in Seattle, welcome to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. We're starting off today with a very important case before the Supreme Court. When the government believes a child is in a bad situation, sometimes that child ends up in foster care, and they could eventually be adopted. For Native kids, federal law requires states to notify tribes about the process and to prioritize placing the children with relatives, other members of their tribe, or other Native families. Congress passed the Indian Child Welfare Act in 1978 to help remedy a long history of atrocities committed against Native families. Now, Texas, Louisiana, and Indiana, and seven people, want the law invalidated, arguing it is unconstitutional. And much of the challenge to the law hinges on a major question: whether tribal membership is a political designation or a racial identity. When oral arguments began last week, Washington State Supreme Court Justice Raquel Montoya Lewis was paying close attention.
I've been following it very closely.
She is the first enrolled member of any tribe to sit on a state Supreme Court in the U.S. And during our conversation about the case, Justice Montoya Lewis had a photo of the Carlisle Indian School as her Zoom background. Carlisle was part of the dark period in American history when the U.S. removed hundreds of thousands of Native kids from their homes with the express intent to wipe out Indian language and culture. Members of Justice Montoya Lewis's own family were taken from their parents and placed in tribal boarding schools. She says learning that history is vital to understanding the reason Congress decided to pass a special law protecting Native kids in custody cases.
Over time, again, the policy changed and became much more of a removal policy in terms of removing children and adopting them into white families. By the time we got to the 1970s, when the Indian Child Welfare Act passed, we were talking, depending upon the state and depending upon the success, quote unquote, of those programs, some children had been removed from their families at rates of 75%. Some were lower. And when I say lower, I mean a quarter of Indian children had been removed from their families and placed in white families. So it was really a policy of disconnection from the home community, but also a policy, frankly, of genocide. And a number of tribes who were at the time developing much more sophistication in terms of working with the federal government along the lines of changing policy, developed the Indian Child Welfare Act to talk about the damage that this had created to the Indian family and the necessity of preserving Indian families, not just for the sake of the families, but for the importance of continuing the traditions of tribal communities and ensuring that tribal communities had the ability to continue to live on.
The plaintiffs in this case before the Supreme Court have made three main arguments against the law, and we're going to get to them one by one. The first is whether Congress had the power to pass the Indian Child Welfare Act in the first place. Plaintiffs argue the law doesn't fall under the regulating commerce section of the Constitution. The second argument is that the Indian Child Welfare Act constitutes racially based discrimination. Basically, if the court sees tribal membership as a racial classification instead of a political one, the law would violate the 14th Amendment. Justice Montoya Lewis walked us through the implications of that argument.
I think this is well-treaded law in U.S. federal Indian law. And that law largely comes from the U.S. Supreme Court, starting in the 1700s. And, you know, starting back, way back there, and I promise I won't take you year by year to today, but starting back at that time, the basis of the ability of the U.S. Supreme Court to regulate anything with respect to tribes was the recognition that tribes are Indian nations. They may not be the same as the country of France, for example, in terms of how the federal government recognized them, but they certainly recognized tribes as having sovereign power. Sovereign power to regulate their governments, among many other things. And that government-to-government relationship, while it was not one that I can say was honored from that point forward and there were no problems. Just the opposite was true. The government-to-government relationship has been one that has been the underpinning of those relationships for several hundred years at this point.
And you're getting to an important distinction here that the defenders of ICWA would like to make, which is that tribal identity is a political category and not a racial classification or a racial category. And that's important because, as you say, the ability of the federal government to make agreements, to negotiate with its sovereign nation, is a clear right that the federal government holds under the Constitution. Now, if tribes in this ICWA case are seen as simply a racial classification, then the law could be vulnerable to undermining because of the 14th Amendment and the guarantee of equal protection. Go on. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to make sure folks are following the nuance there.
And I appreciate that because I can sometimes get into the weeds with these kinds of discussions. What we're talking about when we talk about sovereign nations is that they have citizens. I'm a citizen of my nation, of my tribe, in the same way that I'm a citizen of the United States. I have both citizenships. I have the right to vote in my tribe's elections. I have the ability to own land on my reservation. Those are things that governments do. My tribe has a tribal court that is extremely active and very busy. Prior to working for state superior courts and the Washington State Supreme Court, I worked for tribal courts for 15 years. The authority for tribal courts to do those things, including negotiate with states on gaming and what that looks like in many of the states that have gaming tribes and highly negotiated gaming compacts with those tribes that result in a great deal of money going to state budgets. When you then begin to undermine the idea that there are citizens in tribes and tribes are sovereign nations, and that is the entire basis of the Indian Child Welfare Act. Tribes are entitled to participate in hearings that are related to their children, in as much as the parents are allowed to participate. This is not about a racial discrimination. It's about citizenship. And if you take that away, which is really the only basis I can see for saying that the Indian Child Welfare Act is unconstitutional, you undermine 300 years of Supreme Court precedent. That means potentially that the work that's going on in tribal communities in concert with either the state itself or private entities comes to a grinding halt. The questions that are raised about what does it mean to have fishing rights if you no longer have citizenship, for example, we're in a state that had the fishing wars for so long, and I met many people, both Native and non-Native, who have very clear memories of those times. The question then becomes, what does that mean? What does that mean for treaties that regulate the way we do all kinds of things with each other in terms of the federal government and the tribes? So I think that the characterization of that concern as being sort of a, you know, well, that's, you know, you're really making a, you know, an overstatement of how serious this particular case can be. This is just talking about constitutionality of ICWA is absolutely incorrect, because ICWA, like all other federal Indian law, is based upon government to government negotiation, government to government relationships. And once that's gone, we then have a whole host of other things we have to look at.
The lead plaintiffs in this case before the Supreme Court are a white couple who wanted to adopt a little boy who has Navajo and Cherokee heritage. And he ended up in the custody of the state, and his mother agreed to his adoption by this white family, the Brookines. An extended family member who's Native also wanted to adopt the little boy. The Brookines eventually prevailed, but they felt that there were too many barriers to the adoption and that they were last in line in the process, and that that was not in the best interest of the little boy or of them as a family. And so they joined the lawsuit. This little boy did not live on tribal land. Is there a difference in ICWA cases when a custody case is happening on tribal land and tribal courts versus state courts? And should there be?
So I think that argument certainly seemed to hold some interest for some of the justices who heard the case recently. I don't understand how that argument, again, is one that you can really follow and not trip up again immediately to the concept of tribes being sovereign nations. If we are sovereign nations, and we either are or we aren't, then we have the ability to address, help, respond to, et cetera, our own citizens. And that's where I think there's the tension that you're talking about. If the removal of hundreds of thousands of children over the course of the last 300 years had never happened, and we had intact families, and again, I want to underscore, I come from a family with generations of removal, whether it's to institutional care like the boarding schools or other kinds of out-of-home care. This is something that I have experienced in talking to every family I have ever met on tribal reservations. And I have worked on upwards of 20 tribal reservations where I'd be in a position to ask people that question. This affects all of us. So if we were only able to address those kinds of problems, if there's problems in a family, for example, on our reservation, we would be missing, in some cases, two-thirds of our community. With respect to the specific question that you're asking around this mother choosing these adoptive parents, the Indian Child Welfare Act doesn't prevent that from happening. I have presided over adoptions where, as a group and the tribe is involved and agrees, this is the best placement for the child. That happens. That happens in state courts, it happens in tribal courts. What happened here was there was an objection because there was, and tribes can be parties to these cases. And in this case, they objected. They have a right to do so under the law because they are, again, protecting not just their communities, but the continuation of those communities, and that includes children. So I really want to be clear that I recognize the complexity of these cases when they get to this level in the court system. It's incredibly traumatic and difficult, and that applies perhaps most importantly to the child. But as I have said thousands of times when I have trained judges on how to follow the Indian Child Welfare Act, and I've trained judges all over the country, if you follow the Indian Child Welfare Act the way it's supposed to be followed in the first place, you don't end up with these problems. It is very well laid out how to do this correctly.
And do you mean by that there is an earlier opportunity to involve tribes in these cases and get a placement that is more appropriate, that doesn't later then lead to another removal and separation that's potentially traumatic? Or how do you mean that will circumvent problems?
There's a whole section, both in the law itself as well as regulations associated with the law, that talk about how you properly notify tribes. If you've properly notified a tribe and a tribe is not participating or declines to participate, I should probably say, you can continue to proceed Now, that doesn't mean a tribe can't come in later, and often they do because they know the case is going on. They don't have the resources to come in early. Those are cases where we're talking often about resource-heavy cases. If you're talking about a private adoption, that's sort of going to be a two or three court hearing type of case, and you properly notify the affected tribe or tribes as soon as you know that there's a connection. And in this case, they knew immediately. There was no secret that this child had the potential to be a member of at least one, perhaps two tribes. If they had properly notified those tribes, I would argue, and I would argue, you know, when these things get to become a mess later, if the judge properly follows that and recognizes the power of the objection by the tribe, you don't end up in these situations. Where people get squirrely is when you have a situation like a birth mom who says, I picked these parents, this is where I want the child to go. And I think that's a really difficult situation. And I recognize that there are, there's no easy answer there. But again, I think if you follow what it requires the court to do, and the court can inform the birth mother at court hearings what they're required to do, you may find that there are far more family members that support that young woman or family than she may have been aware of. I've held a court hearing like that, and her first choice absolutely was for her child to go with her family members, but she didn't know that they were interested. Send notice out to the families, out to the tribes, and you get those families to come in. So I think that that is the trickiest part for people to understand. And I think that people think when they read a case like this, it is awful to think about what happens if the child is removed from that family. And we have many examples to look back on to say we know what that looks like, and it is absolutely trauma. On the other hand, there were ways to prevent such a situation and have that child be in a position to know they were loved, not just by their adoptive families, but by their native community of whom they are a member.
I want to move on. There's a third argument that these plaintiffs are making, and it involves the argument that the federal government is overreaching and dictating how states conduct family law cases. The plaintiffs say that the federal government here with ICWA is violating the 10th Amendment, which prevents the feds from forcing states to enforce federal law. Now, we don't have time to get into the particulars of that argument, but what I'm curious about is if the Supreme Court, because this is a very closely split court on this issue. It's a 5-4, it looks like, situation so far. There could be, because Justice Gorsuch has joined the liberals during oral arguments, signaling that he is more in line to uphold ICWA, whereas five conservative justices seem to be more critical of ICWA. We certainly don't know how anyone's going to come down on this yet. There's no decision. But if the court, for example, decides that there is merit in the argument that the federal government has overreached with ICWA, but the court does not support the argument that ICWA is racially discriminatory, what happens, say, in Washington state, where we do have a Washington Indian Child Welfare Act of our own that's been passed since 2011. Does the law continue in Washington state and pretty much the process of placing Native kids in foster care and adoption continues without a change?
I think that's probably a question I can't answer, since that's something that's likely to come in front of the court at some point if we get into that situation. But we're not the only state that has its own ICWA, and it's certainly the larger goal in the discussions of passing state-based Indian Child Welfare Act was, if and when a day like the one you suggested comes, that there's some sort of backup. But I don't know what that looks like. I think, as I said, it's likely to come in front of the court, and so I'm sort of careful to stay away from those questions. But again, those are questions of really a first impression that I think we're going to really have to grapple with.
If the Supreme Court decides that there's merit in the argument that tribal identity in this case is a racial category and that ICWA violates the equal protection portion of the Constitution, is there a potential that this upends the way that Native kids are placed and adopted going forward? I mean, does this change everything for Native kids and tribal sovereignty?
Yes. I don't think there's any question. I don't think you can look at this law as siloed off from other federal Indian law policies or laws passed by Congress. If you take the position, and if the court does this and says tribal membership is a racial category and it's a racial identity like all others, as opposed to a citizenship-based identity, that really removes the existence of citizenry in a sovereign nation. I'm not sure what a sovereign nation looks like without its citizens. I don't think we have the answer to that question unless we go back 300 years, and I certainly don't want to go back that far for the answer to that. But I really don't know what that is going to do. And again, that raises other questions for me in terms of what happens with all of these really thousands of negotiated agreements, contracts, you know, state and tribal required negotiation around things like waterways, and more recently how to respond to something like a pandemic, which worked very well in terms of the state tribal relationship because there had been years leading up to what do we do when there's a pandemic and we need to respond. And very early on there was discussions about, well, we have to involve and consult tribes, and there was a plan. In the absence of those plans and those discussions, I don't know what that would have looked like. How would tribes have gotten vaccine, for example? There was a plan for that. So I just think that there are hundreds of ways that, you know, we haven't even really considered about what it would look like to say being Native American is a racial identity, not a citizenship-based identity, and that's the basis upon which the court invalidates ICWA. So if the court invalidates ICWA on that basis, I think we have some very significant questions about what that means for tribes moving forward.
I could really talk to you all day about this, Justice. It's fascinating, and I can tell the passion that you bring and your own lived experience that you bring to this as Washington State's first Supreme Court Justice who is Native herself. And I really appreciate your perspective, both the legal and life experience that you've brought to this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I look forward to future discussions.
That's State Supreme Court Justice Raquel Montoya Lewis, and I also spoke to Lonnie Greninger. She's vice chairwoman of the Jamestown Sklallam Tribe and also tribal co-chair of Washington State's Department of Children, Youth, and Families Tribal Policy Advisory Committee. And Lonnie co-wrote a statement last week urging the Supreme Court to reject the challenge to ICWA. But she told me she recognizes the extremely sensitive nature of cases like this, and she thinks that it's possible for non-Native families, including the plaintiffs in Holland versus Brackeen, to believe they have the best interest of Native kids at heart.
The system itself in which the Indian Child Welfare Act is built is not perfect. You know, I've heard frustrations before from non-Native families who have tribal children. You know, it's like, hey, I feel like the tribe is coming in last minute and swooping in and taking my kid away from me, who I've bonded with for the last 6 years. Like, why now? Why now, tribe? And I can see how that feels yucky. There is going to be something that they cannot innately offer to that child. If you are not of that tribal descent, some of that culture is innate. Some of it can be taught. We have tribal elders, you know, who grew up away from the reservation just because of the way that our land disbursement happened. You know, we lost our land, and so families went everywhere. You know, they grew up, they didn't even know they were Native, and they come back and they learn. But there is something within their DNA that helps them reconnect. I do wonder if non-Native family, you know, can they even offer something like that? And so that's when we deal with these things on a local basis, we have tribes and intermarried families. And so what we try to help our non-Native families understand is, okay, you're not going to be able to offer them the innate culture that we need that child to be immersed in. Bring them to the tribe. So it is so difficult. And, you know, I'm sure that there might be listeners out there going, well, gosh, Lonnie, you don't seem very sympathetic to those non-Native families who have spent their time, love, money, effort, you know, disciplining the children, investing in them, buying them all the things they need to survive and thrive. I guess what I would say to those is, you know, I get it. And while it might be hard to understand, is you're still having to understand that this child is connected politically and deeply spiritually to a land and a people. And that has to be maintained. And if you can't give that to them innately, then you have to stay connected to that tribe somehow. And that's why tribes fight so hard, because if that innate connection is broken, you end up with children who have broken identities, and then they walk through the world not understanding why.
Lonnie Greninger with the Jamestown Tsklallam Tribe. She was also part of a gathering in front of the Supreme Court last week in Washington, D.C., where tribal members and allies from all over the country stood in solidarity while the justices were hearing oral arguments in the ICWA case. And I'll get out of the way and let Lonnie describe that scene.
When the invitation came out, as a tribal leader, I just felt like I needed to be there. There's this, in a good way, a compulsive feeling, like I have to be there, this sense of urgency. And really, I believed it was a sacred urgency. And so I wanted to be there. And when I got there, I wasn't really sure what to expect. I kept checking in with the executive director of the National Indian Child Welfare Association. And Sarah Kastelic, she was letting me know, you know, we're expecting a good couple hundred people. And, you know, could your role be, would you offer a closing prayer for the event? I was like, oh my gosh, you know, so it made this sense of urgency even stronger. But the one thing that struck me was how peaceful it was. Yes, there was concern. Yes, there was frustration, maybe even some anger for what was happening. You know, our part of the identity of our very sovereignty is being attacked, you know, right there in that very courtroom that we're standing on the steps on. But even then, it was the peaceful American Indian, Alaska Native people. You know, we are this peaceful gathering who are hoping and praying for our children to be saved from a system that has really been, you know, neglecting and abusing them for generations now. And we're trying to maintain as much protection as possible. I don't know, it felt a lot like home to me. We have something here called intertribal, where we have tribes that gather around like once a month, and we share songs and food and culture together. And that's what it felt like to me. It felt like a very home-based ceremony where, you know, tribes represented from all over Indian country are getting up, sharing words, sharing prayers, sharing songs, sharing dances, sharing sage or cedar, other things that they burn in ceremony. Someone even brought a little pair of baby moccasins, you know, to put in the middle of the circle so we could be consistently reminded about why we're there. It felt homey to me, peaceful and homey. And the conversations, you know, as we were standing next to different folks who are both Native and non-Native, so we have allies from everywhere, It's just, you know, hey, why are you here? You know, so everyone would tell their story about why you're here. It's like, oh, wow, well, I'm from this state and I'm from this tribe and this is why I'm here. And here's the sign I'm holding. And it felt good to be around people and to share a sacred and significant event with them. In some sense, you know, it kind of creates even a bond between us strangers who are there for a common good, but not stranger maybe in the spiritual sense, because we're all here for the same reason, Native peoples and allies. But that is what I felt. I felt safe. I wanted to end with a song of love for our people. And that could include, you know, love for our ancestors, love for our peers who are here with us today and our children, and then also love for our generations to come. And so I chose a song that was actually written by Joseph Price from one of my sister tribes. He's from Port Gamble, Squallam. He wrote that song particularly for his grandmother. So it's called the Seiya song. Seiya is grandmother in our language. And he shared that song with Jamestown in particular. And in fact, my family, specifically the Grinnell family, for an honoring for my own grandmother, actually. And the words go, I love my grandmother. But when you say it in the Squallam language, itauch, and say, yeah, I love my grandmother. And he said, you know, you can change the words according to the context of the event. And so that day we said, itauch nischayacha, which is, I love my friends and family. And I wanted to bring this message of whatever happens and whatever is happening here today, it was done in peace and in love. And there was a lot of us during that ceremony that were just praying for us. It was almost like a sense of faith. And I know that can be a Christianese type of word, but faith in whatever faith we know, or spirituality that we know, there was a sense of, we will prevail. Our higher powers are gonna help us prevail. And so that was the message I wanted to bring through that prayer song. And then after that, I did pray in both Musqueam/Tsleil-Waututh and in English, just focusing on that we are strong because of our love, we are strong because of our peace, but we also need a lot of wisdom, a lot of strength for perseverance, and we need a lot of compassion for whatever might come, because we know that there are folks, you know, all over the spectrum who support the Indian Child Welfare Act and tribal sovereignty. And then, you know, there's folks on the other end who don't. And then you got everyone in between. But what I wanted to do was end it with the message that I was feeling from the very beginning. Love and peace is what will bring us strength through this.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. Don't forget you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org or on your favorite podcast app.